You're listening to Panel Borders, which is the podcast version of Resonance FM's weekly show about the world of comics. I'm Alex Fitch, and this week's episode is the first of this month's series of shows looking at the links between education and comic books. I'm talking to author Apostolis Doxiadis about the graphic novel Logicomics, which he co-wrote with computer scientist Christos Papadimitriou from the University of California in Berkeley. The graphic novel centres around the life of Bertrand Russell and explores the history of mathematics in the 20th century, intertwined with the story of the authors grappling with the project's creation. We're looking at the interesting structure of the graphic novel and how this relates to its subject matter, plus the nature of modern biographical comic books. First, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner. FM accepts donations in the form of cheques, credit and debit cards, bank transfers, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
I'm talking to Apostolis Doxiadis about his graphic novel Logicomics. You've written a variety of novels before about mathematicians and logicians. What was it about this particular project that you thought it should be told in comic book format?
Well, actually, I've written novels before, and I've written a novel about a mathematician, and I've written stuff around mathematics, but I wouldn't define myself as a, you know, mathematical novelist. I don't think it's a genre. I think it's I write about, the, like most authors, about the things I love and the things I'm passionate about, and because I studied mathematics many years ago and understand something more of it and love it, one subject was carved from mathematics, but I think authors tend to rationalize or to sanitize their reason for doing things once they are done, trying to make them seem as much more conscious and planned than they actually were. So let me go backwards in time and say that as I was working on the book, you know, it took 5 years to complete, I realized what a great form it was for the subject. But even early, when we first took the decision, it was really more a matter of chance than anything else, in the sense that I've always wanted to say, to tell this story. This is, Logicomics is based on a true story of the quest for the foundations of mathematics, of absolute truth in mathematics. I always wanted to tell that story, but I didn't think I could write a historical novel. As a reader, I love history and I love fiction, but I don't like historical fiction. I don't know why. It's just, you know, my taste. And because people cannot write the books that they don't like to read, I always knew what it was I disliked about me writing a historical novel. I thought that a historical novel requires a lot of work on the part of the author to introduce you to the atmosphere of an era, of a place and a time, and a lot of work of description and detail to make that authentic, otherwise it doesn't work. And as a writer, I'm much more oriented towards actions and emotions and thoughts and dialogue and ideas than atmosphere and description. Some other writers like that a lot. I don't. Maybe I'm not very good at it. That's why I don't like it, or I don't like it because I'm not good at it. And so, in a sense, when I met my old friend Alekos Papadatos, who had been working, we'd been friends for years, and he and Dani, his wife, had been working for 20 years as animators. And they told me that we decided that our soul is not in animation, and we want to go back to our adolescent the love of our adolescence, graphic novels, and we're looking for an idea. Suddenly I said, hey, wait a minute, I have an idea. And I think the trick for me was that that way I would get the best of both worlds, you know. I would get the best of the world of images and visual storytelling, and I would leave the job of describing the Iran and the atmosphere to them, mm-hmm. whereas I could concentrate more on the story and the characters. Okay, yeah, that was the reason why the first decision was taken, but it didn't take long for me to realize that it was a wonderful form for the ideas. Mm. Well, needless to say, though, of course, I knew graphic novels and I loved them. I had always been a comics fan, but only as a reader before that.
In terms of how comics are received in Greece, are there many adults who read comics?
No, there aren't. I would say that the situation in Greece is an exaggeration of what it is in other countries, in the sense that, you know, serious readers think comics are for kiddies, and there's a very, very, like in other countries, there's a very small, very devoted, very xenophobic of other cultures, culture of comics fans and readers, and there are very few actual comic books produced at any level of quality in Greece, and there are a few dozen people who write and design them, but mostly are read by one another. And in the Greek market, the Logic Comics came out in Greece last year, although it was originally written in English. It was translated by me and first came out in Greece. It became a huge success, and not just in the comics world. And this surprised the comics people more than anyone else, because it was the first time that a graphic novel in Greece became a bestseller in the class of, you know, fiction, competing with the big fiction bestsellers. It's great to speak to comics people because, you know, I speak to books people or to maths people, and frankly, I'd rather speak to comics people. So your interest in comics has been long, or?
Yes, well, ever since I was, you know, so high.
You see, the thing is, everyone's has been ever since, but then they stopped. So people who continue are important. Huh? Because when people are little, they read comics. But
in your introduction to the book, in the discussion you have with the other creators on the page, you say that you don't want this to be like the many comics there are that sort of are an introduction to philosophy, an introduction to maths, or sort of brief biography of various creators. So presumably you thought that there was a gap in the market for actually something that's both a fairly serious biography of one of these geniuses of the early 20th century, as well as something that also will introduce casual readers to his work in perhaps a way they hadn't come across before.
Well, I actually don't think that way. You know, when I'm involved in a project, I don't think market and I don't think of places in the market. I know that...
Well, I mean, I guess gap in the market is too kind of... too much of a marketing term. What I mean is that it's something that's kind of missing in a way, you know.
I don't think that way because, because not because I'm, you know, I'm not playing, I'm being an intellectual snob saying this, or I'm saying, you know, that I'm above money or success. Obviously, I enjoy it as much as anyone else, but I cannot work except on projects that I'm totally devoted to. And I can only be totally devoted to a project, especially a project that was so long and so complex in its production, if I'm mad about it and I'm obsessed with the idea. And I became obsessed with the idea, and then I didn't think anything except that I wanted to write this book. And when people ask me, my colleagues believed much less than I did that it would succeed. When I did think about it, and they did ask me, I thought that it would probably be successful in the market as well, but that was not what was driving me. And I think, you know, frankly, that the book, to me at least, is a novel of ideas, a graphic novel of ideas, in the sense that it's about some real people, but mostly about the ideas and the passions around them. And if it also introduces some readers to some concepts, that's great. But that's not the reason we did it.
Sure.
Not as an educational tool, but as a good story about human beings.
One of the concepts that interested Bertrand Russell during his life was the idea of sets. And it was one of the concepts he came across that sort of changed his ideas as he went through his life. And the structure of the graphic novel, that it begins in the present with you and your collaborators talking about the project. Then it goes back in time to him delivering a lecture in the Second World War, and then within that lecture he tells stories of his own life. It's almost like sets in a way as well the structure of the book, that it's one way of telling a story within another way of telling a story within another. And I mean, you say you don't think about these things when it comes to making the project, but the structure of the book almost kind of reflects some of the ideas that Russell had about logic as well.
Yes, well, I would say again that I accept that. I see that it is that way. And as we began to work on the book, we became more and more conscious of an analogy there. But again, although I'm a great believer in structure and in technique, and I think that any storyteller in any medium should try to keep a balance between intuition and inspiration and emotion and conscious craft and technique. And if the first one takes the upper hand, you get a mess. And if the second one takes the upper hand, you get something lifeless. I think that I'm not, in that sense, a formalist. You know, I think the idea is that what you say can be used descriptively. But when you get to the point of saying, because this is an analogy with sets, let's do this, so it is an analogy with a concept in set theory, that is a very cerebral thing, and it works only perhaps for a few experts. And, you know, we don't write for experts. I think, though, on the other hand, what you say is interesting in that this notion of the framed narrative or the sort of Russian doll structure, which is there, is also a very old narrative technique. It's there in the Thousand and One Nights. It's there in all sorts of stories. And we did enjoy very much the challenge of doing these transitions, going from time A to time B to time C and jumping backwards and forwards without disrupting the reader's attention and the sense of continuity. And I think that's one of the beautiful things that you can do with comics that perhaps you cannot do with any other form. Say you can have, and there are pages in Logic Comics which combine three different periods separated by 30 years, each one from the other. And there are three rows on the same page. And the reader's eyes can, you know, can flow down the page and take in this difference and not think twice about the fact that there are such huge temporal gaps between the action and rhythm as a unity. I think it's something that comics can do much better than anything else.
Well, and presumably in terms of the influences on the narrative structure, since the comic ends with you and your collaborators visiting a production of a classical play, the idea of a Greek chorus commenting on the events seems applicable to the way that you introduce yourself into the story as well, to talk about what it is that you're writing.
I would say that's true. I would say that's true. I think that, you know, it's funny, again, the basic reason why we introduced ourselves into the writing is that this book took actually 5 years of full-time work by four people to create. But before those 5 years, there were another 2 years where we met. We were all doing other things, but met frequently and chatted about it. So by the time we actually started to work on it, on a strong synopsis, which guided us through the work, basically, we had been talking so much about it. We had been developing, you know, little attitudes towards it, and each one of us was almost becoming a typecast as, you know, the skeptic and the clown and the nerd and the, you know, we were sort of adopting different stances towards the project, that by the time we started, we thought that our own reactions to it were so much a part of us thinking about the project that it seemed sort of natural to include it in the book. I think as the book, again, as the work developed, it proved to be useful in many ways, one of which is, for example, to assimilate, to unite two different viewpoints on the meaning of the story, the viewpoint of Christos, my co-author, and my own, and rather than iron out our differences or make a decision by vote or committee, to include both slightly different views inside the book, of the story, inside the story. The other thing, of course, was that because all of us had a different relationship to mathematics and a different level of sophistication, the team really worked as a sort of go-between between the reader and us in terms of understanding the ideas there. For example, the two comics artists, Alekos and Ani, who knew less about mathematics and cared less, maybe, Ani especially, would act as, you know, this character called Simplicio in Galileo's dialogues about physics, where he has a sort of the convenient ignoramus who is there to ask the questions of the lowest common denominator of the audience. Yeah.
Which, so, again, is a trope throughout fiction, you know, Watson again, to Sherlock again, Holmes exactly. and Doctor Who's many companions.
Exactly, yeah. exactly. The sidekick, of course. But, yeah, and one of the sidekicks... Role is to be, you know, saying the stupid things that can make the hero shine even more, but also to explain things, you know, to ask the questions that perhaps an average reader would, if there is such a being, would ask. So that worked that way too.
In terms of writing it as a comic, did you, when it came to giving the script to the artists, did you say, you know, I want so many panels on this page, or was it a more of a rough outline with the script and what you wanted to see in general?
I hadn't written a comic book before, but I had directed two feature films.
Yeah.
So I did have a lot of experience in the visual medium. And also, Alekos came from the world of animation. So we both had a strong background in film in various capacities. So, no, we used the technique of the full script, that mean, which means that every panel was described in great detail. We also used technical language. I used technical language, so the description, the script for a panel would read row 2, panel 1, roughly a third of the row wide, and a fifth of the page tall. And at the left and the foreground, we have in medium close shot character X looking at three quarters right to so and so, who is in the background to the far right in long shot. And so we had this. This was done very, very technically. And then we had a session with Alekos where I would go by 10 pages at a time, working on the synopsis. And we would put those on the board, and we would use a technique that he told me that was used in animation studios, pioneered by Disney, where Disney would have himself, old Walt, would have all the storyboard on the board, on the wall, and then he would play all the parts, doing the voices and doing the grimaces and so on, while the sketching, the, you know, artists were sketching madly away. So I would actually read the script to Alekos and play the parts, would not do voices perhaps, but do, you know, face expressions and gestures and movements and illustrate the action to him. And then he would do roughs, and we put those up and we would discuss those. And then after the roughs, he would go away and do the pencils. But by the time he did the pencils, we both of us had understood very well what was happening and had collaborated on affecting one another's vision of it.
Was he your ideal choice of an artist right from the start of the project, or did you audition various people for the role?
He was my one and only choice ever. Well, part of the reason was that I didn't know anyone else. In the sense, no. And I was in Greece, I mean.
Yeah.
I live in Greece, I'm based there, and I would like to have a personal relationship with the artist, but mostly it was because I had enormous respect for his talent. I knew his work very well, we were close friends, and I was totally impressed by his ability because of his long years in animation and his talent, but also experience, to do anything I would ask him to. And I think that was one of the greatest joys of working on this book as a writer, was to have an artist that I knew could deliver anything I wanted. I never had to think, but can he draw this? For example, in a film, often when you're writing a script, you think, you know, this will cost too much, this scene, could this actor play that scene, or could I give this scene the right atmosphere, or the right amount of drama? But here I could just be certain that he would do it, and it worked that way, and it was wonderful.
Because in terms of the artwork, it actually does seem like you're tapping into the zeitgeist a bit in terms of the kind of comics that are popular at the moment, because the whole kind of Claire Lean style from 1960s French comics seems to be coming back into fashion with Garen Ewing's The Rainbow Orchid. There's a webcomic by David O'Connell as well, which is in a similar style. And I think when it comes to telling stories that have a historical aspect to them and require the rendering of actual people and actual buildings, then that sort of clarity of line is something that works very well with the subject matter.
Well, I would say that this comes from two or three things. One is that both Legos and I absolutely loved as kids and still love as adults and as fathers of kids, rereading all the greats with our kids, Hergé. He's, for both of us, a great god. And we absolutely love his work and his vision and his humanity, I would say. And I think that the fact that I can think of this period, you know, the 20s, perhaps in a romantic, unrealistic light, but for storytelling, unrealistic and romantic is fine, as so beautiful and so warm and so interesting visually, is also due to my sense of it in books such as Ottokar, Scepter, or, you know, the early Tintins of the 20s and 30s, which captures so beautifully and in such loving detail the atmosphere of the times. And Lynn Claire so was, in that sense, for two reasons, both because it worked for the era and because we loved it as an obvious choice. Also, Alekos is of the French school in the sense that he did his training and his first years of work in animation in France, so he was more a child of the French and Belgian school than the Americans, say. And the third thing was, of course, that we thought, both of us thought, and Alekos knew that from animation, and I guess I knew that from writing, that if you have a long form, as you know, this is the 350-page graphic novel, as the prose should not be too beautiful in a novel, the art should not be too beautiful in a comic book. It should be beautiful, but in a way that is not obstructive. And Alekos was telling me that this is something they are always taught. Young people in entering animation are always taught that you should always serve the story. The images always serve the story. So, you know, John Huston, the great film director, used to say that when a director dies, he becomes a photographer. And so Alekos and I have adapted this to when a comics artist dies, he becomes a painter. So we didn't want painting. We wanted art serving storytelling. And I think that Lynn Claire serves this beautifully.
And if you don't mind me asking this in terms of you having to almost answer for other people, but you're actually the first biographer that I've interviewed. What is it that appeals to you, investigating another person's life and then editing it in a way for people who perhaps are unfamiliar with them as a person rather than as a concept?
I can only speak for myself, and I think many biographers would at least partly disagree with me, but I don't consider myself a biographer in this book, in the sense of, I think if a biographer is writing a biography of a certain real person, although they know that the act of composition is itself artistic and there must obviously be selection and personal preferences count and personal perceptions of certain things count and so on and so forth, they really, deep down, they want to serve their subject. In this case, although it is a biography, not just of one person, but I would say it's the biography of an idea in a sense, of a quest in which many people were involved, but in which we chose, for reasons that were partly dramatic and partly historical, to focus on Bertrand Russell and also use him as a narrator. I would say that, to me, the god I was constantly feeling I was owing, I was pledging allegiance to, was the god of fiction and not the god of history. So at any one moment, I wanted this to be a good story. We didn't take major liberties with the truth. The only liberties we took are minor, in the sense of, for example, we had cases of people who in real life corresponded, got communicated only through letters or through journal articles, and we would have them meet and discuss their ideas. We did little things like that, but we didn't invent any strange events. But actually, I think that the way this story is put together, the way in which we united the strands of the lives of different people and put them all in the same story with a beginning and a middle and an end, is itself an invention, although the facts themselves are not. The composition is really an invention. So I would say, you know, that I don't know about biographers, because to me this is a work of fiction based on a reality.
Mm. But I guess you got to know Russell better as you worked on the project, perhaps more than when you started it.
Well, certainly, and that was partly due to a lot of research, but I had done most of the research when we started. I would say I certainly liked him much more as the project developed, because strangely, when we started work on the project, I didn't like him very much, as many people don't. I mean, Russell is not usually some people may refer to him with admiration, or some people are fans of his ideas and say on atheism or materialism or the role of logic and so on, but he's not a person that would, inspire love in people's hearts. And I think part of the reason is that he was rather cold, and you feel that he's didn't form any deep emotional bonds with people, lasting deep emotional bonds with people or ideas, and he was in some way a dilettante. Of course, of the truth, not in that part of his life where he was very seriously devoted to a task. But the more I worked on the project, the more I begin to feel for him and to understand how all this deep yearning for truth, which led to his lifelong struggle grappling with the various foundational problems of mathematics at first, and then of physics and politics and so on, was motivated by a very deep personal insecurity, which was placed in his heart during his childhood. And I think at heart, you know, he was, to the end of his life, a lonely child looking for affection and meaning and love, and perhaps meaning or intellectual meaning as a substitute for love. And I think that the more I realized that in action, in his actions, the more I grew to love him.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Logicomics, An Epic Search for Truth, is available now in all good bookshops, published in English by Bloomsbury Publishing. More info at logicomics.com. As it's December, there are a myriad of opportunities to buy the work of small press comic creators in different locations. At Shoreditch Town Hall, 380 Old Street, from the 3rd to the 6th of December, the East End Arts Club will be running a Christmas fair called Take the Biscuit, featuring art by comic book creators such as Daniel Locke and a variety of lo-fi street artists. More info at eastendartsclub.co.uk. Also in the East End, and also from the 3rd to the 6th of December, there's the Guest Projects Christmas Market at Yinka Shonibari Space, 1 Andrews Road, London, in East 8. This features zines such as Impulsive Random Platform, and you can find more info at www.guestprojects.com for details. In the other alt tourist mecca, heading towards northwest London, Camden Lock is a good place to buy small press comics, with Tom McAnally's small press stall featuring Semiotic Cohesion and comics by Howard Hardiman and Melody Lee in the market from Thursdays to Sundays. More info about all the above can be found on our blog, www.panelborders.wordpress.com. In the next episode, I'm looking at another epic biographical graphic novel, but one about a very different character, as I'm talking to another biographer, Reinhard Kleist, about his graphic novel, Johnny Cash, I See a Darkness. Thanks for listening.